Good afternoon, and welcome, one and all. The popular music of the 1940s and 1950s grew out of a remarkable period of change. In the early 1940s, dance bands and large orchestras were still at the center of popular entertainment. Their music filled ballrooms, theaters, and radio programs, while singers often appeared as featured vocalists with the band rather than as stars entirely in their own right. During the war years, familiar songs carried an enormous amount of feeling. They offered reassurance, companionship, and reminders of home. A melody heard on the wireless could become part of the shared experience of millions of people. After the war, the singer gradually moved towards the front of the stage. Microphone technique allowed voices to become quieter and more intimate. Performers no longer needed to sing as though they were trying to reach the back of a large hall. They could sound as if they were speaking directly to one listener. At the same time, arrangers and conductors were finding new ways to use the recording studio. Strings became richer, vocal groups were added behind solo singers, and orchestras could create effects designed especially for the record rather than for a live dance floor. By the 1950s, popular music included crooners, close harmony groups, novelty songs, film themes, Latin American rhythms, and polished orchestral instrumentals. Records were becoming shorter, brighter, and more immediate, but the finest of them still had careful arrangements and musicianship behind every note. Across the program, the arrangements will be as important as the voices, because each record was designed to make its character clear almost immediately. We begin with one of the most distinctive voices of the period. It's Doris Day, with Paul Weston and his orchestra, and A Guy Is a Guy.
I walked down the street like a good girl should. He followed me down the street like I knew he would. Because a guy is a guy wherever he may be. So listen and I'll tell you what this fella did to me. I walked to my house like a good girl should. He followed me to my house like I knew he would. Because a guy is a guy wherever he may be. So listen while I tell you what this fella did to me. I never saw the boy before, so nothing could be sillier. At closer range, his face was strange, but his manner was familiar. So I walked up the stairs like a good girl should. He followed me up the stairs like I knew he would. Because a guy is a guy wherever he may be. So listen and I'll tell you what this fella did to me. I stepped to my door like a good girl should. He stopped at my door like I knew he would. Because a guy is a guy wherever he may be. So listen while I tell you what this fella did to me. He asked me for a goodnight kiss. I said it's today. I would have told him more, except his lips got in the way. So I talked to my ma like a good girl should, and ma talked to pa like I knew she would, and they all agreed on a married life for me. The guy is my guy wherever he may be. So I walked down the aisle like a good girl should. He followed me down the aisle. And now you've heard the story of what someone did to me. That's what he did to me.
Doris Day recorded A Guy Is a Guy in 1952, and it became another substantial success in a career already filled with popular records and films. The song was written by the Canadian-born folk singer and broadcaster Oscar Brand. Its roots lay in an older soldier's song, but Brand reshaped the idea into something suitable for the popular market, and Doris Day gave it just the right mixture of innocence and quiet amusement. Her performance is a useful reminder that novelty material still requires first-rate technique. The words move quickly, the story has to remain clear, and the singer must suggest the humor without stopping the musical flow. Miss Day does all of that without appearing to work at it. Paul Weston's orchestra provides a light, tidy accompaniment. The arrangement never competes with the lyric. It gives the voice a firm, rhythmic setting and allows the little changes in the story to make their effect. There is also a conversational ease in the recording. Doris Day sounds less like she is performing to a large theatre and more as though she's sharing an amusing incident with one listener. That quality would become increasingly important as popular singing moved away from the ballroom and into the home through records and radio. From a song centered on the singer, we turn to a record in which the orchestra itself provides the drama. Percy Faith and his orchestra are next with Delicado. Delicado was written by the Brazilian composer and virtuoso cavaquinho player, Walder Azevedo. Percy Faith recorded his arrangement in New York in March 1952, and it became one of the major orchestral successes of the year. The most immediately recognizable feature is the harpsichord, played by Stan Freeman. That crisp, slightly brittle sound cuts cleanly through the orchestra and gives the record a character quite unlike the broad string arrangements usually associated with Faith. Around it, the percussion and brass create a lively Latin American atmosphere. The performance is colorful. but it is also remarkably controlled. Every accent is placed carefully, and the excitement comes from the arrangement rather than from sheer volume. Percy Faith had a particular gift for recognizing the central feature of a melody and building an arrangement around it. In Delicado, the tune is memorable, but the choice of instrumental color is what turns the record into something instantly identifiable. It also demonstrates how international popular music had become. A Brazilian composition was arranged by a Canadian-born conductor, recorded in New York, and enjoyed by listeners across several continents. The record did not ask its audience to know anything about that journey. Its rhythm and brightness communicated immediately. The next song traveled from a Hollywood film to the popular charts. It was heard over the opening of a story set in Rome, and several singers recorded it almost at once. Here are the Four Aces, featuring Al Alberts, with three coins in the fountain.
Make it mine.
Make it mine.
Please make it mine.
Three coins in the fountain, each one seeking happiness, thrown by three hopeful lovers. Which one will the fountain bless? Three hearts in the fountain, each heart longing for its home. There they lie in the fountain, somewhere in the heart of Rome. Which one will the fountain bless? Which one will the fountain bless? Coins in the fountain, through the ripples how they shine. Just one wish will be granted, one heart will wear a valentine. Make it mine, make it mine, make it mine. Coins in the fountain, through the ripples how they shine.
Just one wish will be granted, one heart will wear a valentine.
Make it mine, make it mine.
Three Coins in the Fountain was written by Jules Stein and Sammy Kahn for the 1954 film of the same name. Frank Sinatra sang it over the opening titles, while scenes of Rome and its fountains established the setting. The song won the Academy Award, and the Four Aces recording became one of the most familiar alternatives to Sinatra's film performance. In Britain, their version reached the top five. The Four Aces had emerged from Philadelphia, and their sound was built around the lead voice of Al Alberts, with the other members supplying close, firmly arranged harmony. Unlike a vocal group aiming for a soft background texture, they sang with considerable weight. The harmonies give the melody a sense of ceremony, while Jack Plesse's orchestra and chorus broaden the sound still further. The idea behind the song is simple. A coin thrown into Rome's Trevi Fountain carries a wish. The film follows three American women living in Rome, and the fountain becomes a symbol of hope, romance, and the possibility of return. What makes the record effective is the way it gradually expands. It begins as a melodic, popular song and grows into something almost processional. The voices remain clear, but the surrounding arrangement makes the 3-minute recording feel connected to the scale and color of a widescreen film. Our next selection needed no expansive treatment. It is short, bright, and delivered by a singer whose records carried a smile even before she reached the comic lines. Here is Alma Cogan with Dreamboat.
You dreamboat, you lovable dreamboat. The kisses you gave me set my dreams afloat. I would sail the seven seas with you, even if you told me to go and paddle my own canoe. Sincerely, I love you so dearly, I'd follow you, darling, to any shore. You dreamboats, you lovable dreamboats, say that you'll be mine forevermore. You dreamboats, you lovable dreamboats, the kisses you gave me set my dreams afloat. Sincerely, I love you so dearly, I'd follow you, darling, to any shore. You dreamboat, you lovable dreamboat, say that you'll be mine forever.
Dreamboat was written by Jack Hoffman and recorded by Alma Cogan with an orchestra conducted by Frank Cordell. In 1955, it became her only British number one single, remaining at the top for 2 weeks. At less than 2 minutes, it is a model of economy. There is no extended introduction and no unnecessary instrumental passage. The record presents its idea, develops it quickly, and finishes while the melody is still fresh in the mind. Miss Cogan's voice was bright, clear, and immediately recognizable. She became known as the girl with the laugh in her voice, a description which suited both her public personality and the buoyant quality of many of her recordings. There was, however, more control behind that brightness than the nickname might suggest. She shapes the words precisely, keeps the rhythm lively, and gives the melody enough firmness to prevent the performance becoming merely cute. Frank Cordell's accompaniment supports the youthful quality of the record without overwhelming it. The orchestral figures are compact and purposeful, exactly what a very short commercial single required. The recording belongs to a particular moment in British popular music, just before rock and roll changed the market dramatically. Yet its craftsmanship remains easy to hear. A memorable title, a direct tune, a distinctive singer, and an arrangement which wastes no time. The next record arrived after rock and roll had begun to reshape the charts, but it proved that an established singer with an easy manner could still command an enormous audience. It's Perry Como, with Mitchell Ayers and his orchestra and the Ray Charles Singers, and together they give us Magic Moments.
Magic moments when two hearts are kept. Magic moments
I'll never forget the moment we kissed the night of the hayride. The way that we hugged to try to keep warm while taking the sleigh ride.
Magic moments, memories we've been sharing. Magic moments, when two hearts are caring. Time can't erase the memory of these magic moments filled with love.
The telephone call that tied up the line for hours and hours. The Saturday dance, I got up the nerve to send you some flowers.
Magic moments, memories we've been sharing. Magic moments, when two hearts are caring. Time can't erase the memory.
Cheered whenever our team was scoring a touchdown.
The time that the floor fell out of my car when I put the clutch down.
The penny arcade, the games that we played, the fun and the prizes.
The Halloween hop when everyone came in funny disguises.
Magic moments filled with love.
Magic Moments was written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David and recorded by Perry Como in 1957. Joe Reisman arranged the performance, with Mitchell Ayres and his orchestra and the Ray Charles Singers completing the familiar Como sound. The song is built from a series of small remembered incidents rather than one continuous story. Each detail is ordinary: a ride, a dance, a shared joke. But together, they suggest the way personal memories acquire importance because of the person associated with them. Perry Como was ideally suited to that idea. His delivery is relaxed and direct, with none of the strain that can make a sentimental song feel overworked. He trusts the melody and allows the words to do their job. The arrangement is busier than Como's manner might first suggest. The backing singers answer and support him. The orchestra supplies rhythmic punctuation, and the little vocal effects help separate one memory from the next. Como remains calm at the center, while the setting moves around him. The record became one of his greatest British successes. It reached number one, and stayed there for 8 weeks in 1958. An impressive achievement during a period when younger performers and new styles were arriving rapidly. Magic Moments also came near the beginning of the celebrated Bacharach and David partnership. Their later songs would often contain unexpected melodic turns and more complicated emotional shades. Here, the writing is deliberately simple, but already very carefully constructed. From memories measured in kisses and hayrides, we move to a piece in which time itself becomes unreliable. This is Leroy Anderson and his Pops Concert Orchestra with the Syncopated Clock.
Thank you.
Leroy Anderson wrote The Syncopated Clock in 1945 while he was still serving in the United States Army. He sent the score to Arthur Fiedler, and the Boston Pops introduced it that year. Anderson had an exceptional ability to turn an everyday sound or object into a compact orchestral picture. Elsewhere, he used a typewriter, sandpaper, and sleigh bells. In each case, the unusual sound was not a novelty added to an ordinary tune. It became part of the musical structure. And now it is almost time for me to make way for Albert. Before that, our final record comes from one of Britain's most enduring all-round entertainers. Max Bygraves had worked in variety, radio, theatre, film, and television, and his easy, direct style made him especially effective with songs that invited the audience to join in. Tulips from Amsterdam had begun as a continental European song before English words helped turn it into a British favourite. Bygraves recorded it with Eric Rogers and his orchestra, and it appeared on a double-sided release with You Need Hands.
When it's spring again, I'll bring again tulips from Amsterdam. With a heart that's true, I'll give to you tulips from Amsterdam. I can't wait until the day you fill these eager arms of mine. Like the windmill keeps on turning, that's how my heart keeps on yearning for the day I know we can share these tulips from Amsterdam. From Amsterdam, with a heart that's true, I'll give to you tulips from Amsterdam. I can't wait until the day you fill these eager arms of mine. Like the wind keeps on turning, that's how my heart keeps on yearning for the day I know we can share these tulips from Amsterdam. Share these tulips from Amsterdam.
Hello, Hugh. Hello, everyone. It's lovely to be with you again. Well, I wonder whether your onions have started to tell you they're nearly ready. You may have noticed the leaves beginning to turn yellow and fold over by themselves. Once most of the row looks like that, the bulbs have usually done all the growing they're going to do. There's no need to bend the leaves down, just let them finish naturally, and then choose a dry day to lift them. Use a fork rather than pulling hard on the leaves, and put it into the soil a little way from the bulbs. Onions have a habit of being rather larger underground than they appear from above. Once they're out, lay them on the soil for a while if the weather is settled. If rain is likely, move them somewhere dry and airy. A greenhouse shelf, an open shed, or a covered table will do, provided the air can move around them. You may find one or two with a soft patch, a damaged skin, or a thick neck which doesn't seem to be drying properly. Keep those apart and use them first. The firm bulbs with dry skins are the ones to store. Shallots can be treated in much the same way. Lift the clump carefully, separate the bulbs and spread them out to dry. I always think there's something rather satisfying about that particular job. You plant one small bulb in the cold soil, wait through spring and summer, and then lift a whole handful in its place. It feels like a very fair return for the little bit of patience involved. When the skins are crisp and the necks are completely dry, store the bulb somewhere cool and well ventilated. Then, long after the ground itself has been cleared, you'll still be bringing a small part of the summer into the kitchen. Now, if you grow strawberries, you may be finding long runners stretching away from the plants. At the end of each one, there will often be a little cluster of leaves trying to settle itself somewhere new. If you'd like a few extra plants for next year, choose runners from the strawberries that have been healthy and have given you a good crop. You don't need to keep every runner. Too many will weaken the parent plant, so choose the strongest and remove the rest. The easiest way to root one is to place a small pot of compost beside the strawberry plant. Rest the little plantlet on the surface and hold it in place with a bent piece of wire or a small stone. Don't cut it away from the parent yet. It will still be receiving help through the runner while its own roots are forming. Keep the compost moist, and after a few weeks, give the plantlet a very gentle pull. If it stays firmly in place, it has probably made a good set of roots. You can then cut the runner between the two plants. The new strawberry is ready to grow on by itself. Sometimes a runner will already have rooted into the border before you notice it. If it looks healthy, lift it with some soil around the roots and move it into a pot or another prepared space. There's something rather nice about raising plants this way. You're not asking the strawberry to do anything unnatural. You're simply helping it settle where it can grow properly. And of course, once you have all the young plants you need, remove the remaining runners and give the parent plant a rest. It has already given you fruit and perhaps next year's plants as well. I think that's quite enough to ask of it for one season, don't you? You might also be looking at a wisteria which has sent long shoots across the wall, around the window, or towards somewhere it was never invited to go. Well, those long green shoots can be shortened now. This is only the summer prune, so there's no need to cut them back heavily. Follow each new shoot back towards the main branch and shorten it to about 5 or 6 leaves. That helps to keep the plant within its space and allows more light and air around the older growth. It also encourages the wisteria to put more of its energy into forming flower buds rather than producing yards of stem. I recommend taking a moment to pause before you cut. The shoots often twist around one another, and it's quite easy to follow one with your eyes while your hand has found another. If a healthy shoot is growing towards an empty part of the support, you may decide to keep it. Tie it in loosely with a soft tie and leave enough space for the stem to thicken. Anything that has worked its way behind a pipe or into the gutter is better removed while it is still young. A soft green shoot is easy to move. A thick woody stem in the same place can become a much more difficult problem. When you've finished, the plant should look calmer, but it should still look natural. Wisteria is meant to have movement in it. We're only guiding it. not trying to make every stem stand to attention, then leave it alone to settle. The shorter shoots may not look very important now, but among them, the plant will be preparing the flowers we hope to enjoy next year. Although we're well into summer, there are still one or two things you can sow. You might have a small gap where an earlier crop has finished, or perhaps an empty pot which could be useful again. Rocket, mustard leaves, and some of the oriental salad leaves can still be sown now for picking later. There's no need to sow a large amount. A small patch or a single container may give you all the leaves you need. If the soil is dry, water the area before sowing and allow the moisture to settle. Then sow the seed thinly and cover it according to the instructions on the packet. Keep the soil from drying out while the seedlings are small. They can appear quite quickly in warm ground, and once they're growing well, you can begin picking a few leaves at a time. A container is particularly useful because it can be moved out of the strong afternoon sun and moved to somewhere more sheltered as the sun's position changes. You may also have time for another sowing of radishes. Choose a variety suitable for sowing at this point in the season, because not every radish behaves in quite the same way. Keep them growing steadily. If they become very dry and then start again after watering, the roots can turn woody or become much hotter in flavour. And do watch for slugs around new seedlings. They seem to recognise a fresh sowing of salad leaves almost before we have even finished watering them in. And keep harvesting the outer leaves once the plants are established. Taking a few at a time will allow the centre to carry on growing, and you'll enjoy the crop for much longer than if you wait and cut everything at once. Late sowings can feel like a small act of optimism. The main summer crops may be at their busiest, but you're already making sure there will still be something fresh to pick when they begin to slow down. Now your lavender may be coming to the end of its flowering. The colour will be fading, the stems will feel drier, and there may not be quite so many bees visiting as there were a few weeks ago. That's usually the time to give the plant a light trim. Cut away the flower stems and take off a little of the fresh leafy growth beneath them. About an inch is usually enough. Try to leave the plant in a soft, rounded shape, but don't worry about making it perfectly even. Lavender looks far better when it still has something of its natural form. The important thing is to keep your cuts within the green growth. Avoid cutting deeply into old bare wood, because lavender does not always produce new shoots from it. If the plant has become very woody and has opened out badly in the centre, cutting it back hard may not repair it. It may be better to take a few cuttings from healthy young growth and begin again with a new plant. Once the plant has been trimmed, clear away the loose pieces from around the base and let the air move through it. If you'd like to raise a few new lavender plants, this is also a good time to take some cuttings. Look for short, healthy shoots that haven't flowered. Pull one gently from the main stem so that a small strip of the older stem comes away with it, then remove the lower leaves. Put several around the edge of a small pot filled with gritty compost. Water them lightly and leave the pot somewhere bright, but out of strong sunshine. They don't need to be kept soaking wet. In fact, lavender is much happier if the compost is allowed to drain freely. Not every cutting will grow, of course, so take a few more than you think you'll need. There's something rather hopeful about it. A plant may be becoming woody and tired, but tucked beside it are several young pieces ready to begin again. And while you're near the lavender, have a look at the soil around it. If water tends to sit there after rain, gently open up the surface and make sure fallen leaves haven't gathered around the base. Lavender enjoys sunshine and dry feet. Keeping the crown clear now may save the plant from sitting wet through the colder months. Then step back and enjoy it. The flowers may have finished, but the neat silver-green plant still has an important place in the late summer garden. Before you throw all the flower stems away, keep a few and see whether they still hold their scent. Even when the colour has faded, the fragrance often remains. Here's another thing you can try with the pieces you've cut. Tie a small bunch together and hang it somewhere dry, or simply leave the stems in a bowl for a while. It doesn't need to become a big, time-consuming project. Sometimes it's enough just to bring that scent indoors. Well, before we finish, you may have some work to do among the summer fruiting raspberries. Once a cane has carried fruit, it won't crop again. The older canes are usually browner and drier, and you may still see the remains of the little side shoots which held the raspberries. The fresh canes growing beside them are for next year, so take a moment to make sure you know which are which. Cut the old fruited canes down at the base and remove them from all of the raspberries as you go. If you leave them lying across the new growth, it soon becomes difficult to see what you intended to keep. Also choose the strongest new canes and tie them loosely to the support and give them enough space so that air and light can move between them. Any very weak or awkwardly placed growth can be removed later. One thing to be careful about is the type of raspberry you have. The canes we've been talking about are the summer fruiting sort, which carry their crop on stems grown the year before. Autumn fruiting raspberries behave differently, so don't cut those down now simply because the summer varieties are being pruned. Their fruit may only just be beginning. Once the old summer canes are out of the way, it's a good opportunity to check the supports. Tighten any loose wires and replace ties that have begun to cut into the stems. The new canes may look slim at the moment, but they'll thicken before next year's crop, so give them room. Clear away weeds from the base as well, but work gently because raspberry roots are quite close to the surface. A layer of garden compost around the row will help to hold moisture and improve the soil. Keep it away from the canes themselves rather than piling it against them. You may also find a few new shoots appearing well outside the row. If they're in the way, ease them out while they're small. If you have room for another plant, one of those shoots can sometimes be lifted with some root attached and replanted elsewhere. It's a generous plant, the raspberry. Even while you're clearing away this year's canes, it is often quietly offering you the beginnings of another row. And if there are still a few raspberries hiding among the leaves, do pick them before you finish. They're often the sweetest ones, warmed by the day and easily missed when you first look along the row. It may seem strange to be thinking about next year while there is still so much happening now, but gardens are always doing more than one thing at once, and successfully too. The onions are finishing, young strawberry plants are beginning, and the new raspberry canes are already preparing another crop. So all we really need to do is notice what each plant is trying to do and give it the help it needs at the right time. I hope you find something enjoyable waiting for you in the garden this week, even if it's only the scent of the lavender or the pleasure of lifting the first onions from the soil. Remember, they're magic all around a garden. You just need to learn where to look. Bye-bye for now, and please take good care of yourselves.